ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays.
We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is.
It's serious reporting on global events. Plus you're invited for a daily radio coffee table chat with me, Geraldine Doogue.
And with me, Hamish McDonald. And in 2026, Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Together we'll explore the global forces reshaping our world in mostly calm conversation.
Calm, Geraldine. Global roaming. Weekdays at 11 on ABC Radio National and on the ABC Listen app.
Hello, Natasha Mitchell joining you, and on Big Ideas today, Conspiracy Nation.
You know, conspiracy theories, particularly the ones that are really popular, the ones that take off, often kind of find toeholds in uncomfortable things about ourselves and sometimes lies that we tell about ourselves or failures.
If you're scared of reality, it actually brings you a little comfort clinging to something you think is true. Because they actually find it's easier to live in that fantasy than it is to live in reality.
Conspiratorial thinking has always been with us. It's a human instinct, I think, to tell stories and find meaning in chaos and look for clues and put yourself at the centre of an epic story, which is really what conspiracy theory is, you know, this fight between good and evil.
Yes, conspiracy theories, the idea that the rich or the powerful or the corrupt are manipulating you or your reality without your knowledge and for their benefit. And let's face it, sometimes they are. Well, they're not new, but they have found new ways to get inside our heads. And the fallout for families, for communities, and for people's lives can be huge. As seasoned investigative and technology journalists Ariel Bogle and Cam Wilson discovered, in writing their book Conspiracy Nation, Exposing the Dangerous World of Australian Conspiracy Theories. You'll meet them today on Big Ideas. And let's start with Cam Wilson, who is Associate Editor of Crikey, with an example.
I mean, fundamentally, conspiracy theories are a different understanding of the world that's separate from reality. And when you start to not pay attention to reality, your reality often gets a lot worse. So I spoke to, for example, a woman whose partner got really into kind of QAnon-style conspiracy theories during the pandemic. And so, and kind of all kinds of conspiracies as well, anti-vaccine and stuff. So as you would all remember, it was a time when, you know, there wasn't much information. They were locked down like many of us. And this woman's wife started, you know, worrying that, for example, that there was a vaccine genocide happening and anyone who got vaccinated would be killed, that there were secret tunnels under Melbourne where, children were being trafficked. All of these things because of the incredible stress that we're all under. You know, this huge thing that was happening that, you know, we just, like, didn't know much about. For her way of coping with it was these alternative stories, which, in a weird way, you'd be like, well, that doesn't seem very reassuring. Right, but there is a value, and this is what conspiracy theories do: is they give you an understanding of the world, even if it's wrong. You know, I get it, and there's a comfort in saying I understand it. But despite the fact that she was getting this comfort, it was, of course, you know, a really, really ruining her life. You know, she cared for someone else, and so her work, and they made that hard because of she didn't want to get vaccinated. She, you know, started hoarding food. She started even, as this kind of went on, started becoming just generally a more awful person to kind of be around for her partner. And there was this really awful story about how the wife took her partner, who's believing in conspiracy theories, and said, it's my birthday coming up, let's get away. And they drove across the country through the desert. When they stopped, she would get out and go up hills and jump on top of the car to try and get reception for a phone so she could hear what her conspiracy theory figures were telling her and letting her know about the world. And eventually this all just became too much and their relationship actually broke down and they end up separating. And you know, like it'd be great to have a really happy ending to the story, saying that in the book we actually figured out the cure to all this and we gave it to her and then that's all solved. But the reality is that, you know, these stories, they really damage your own life because you become very often very so obsessed with them to the exclusion of all else. But it also just means it's very hard to hold down a job, to have a relationship. And, you know, even for the people who, you know, they don't believe in them themselves, but they see their family members change. And at some point it can often just become too much.
And joining Cam Wilson and Guardian Australia's Ariel Bogle in this discussion on Big Ideas today are journalists Gavin Fang and Tracy Kirkland. They're co-editors of the books Age of Doubt, Building Trust in a World of Misinformation, and also Pandemedia, How COVID Changed Journalism. Gavin Fang is editorial director at the ABC, where Tracy Kirkland is managing editor of news. Over now to Gavin, who's hosting this event from the stage of the Canberra Writers Festival on the land of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples.
In Conspiracy Nation, Ariel Bogle and Cam Wilson explore one very specific but insidious aspect of this loss of trust, the conspiracy theory and the toll conspiracies are taking on people and their families. As Ariel and Cam write, conspiracy theories are like grime building up on a window, with the only thing that you can see on the other side is the outlines of shadowy figures. At first, the smudges can be ignored. By the time you can barely see through, it can feel difficult or nearly impossible to repair it. Ariel, what a great description. Wipe back that grime for us a bit. What are conspiracies? And what about them motivated you to write this book?
Certainly. So to give us some definitions, in the book we take a conspiracy theory to be the idea that there is a group out there, a shadowy cabal that is plotting evil against the rest of us, the common good. So this is pretty binary. This is good versus evil. This is a evil out-group against, you know, the rest of us, the good in-group. Of course, we're journalists. We acknowledge that there are real conspiracies out there. Part of our day job is exposing power, what power is doing behind closed doors. So we're certainly not saying that no one ever does anything bad or evil out there. But the role, what we wanted to tackle with our book is what happens when conspiratorial thinking takes over, both on an individual level, but a social, you know, community level as well. And Cam and I, you know, we've covered some of the same patches for many years now. So we've just stayed in touch, you know, different corners of the internet, extremism. We were both covering a lot of the false claims and misinformation that was spreading around COVID and COVID vaccines. We were both covering what you might call the anti-lockdown movement or the freedom movement. And it struck us both, I think, that when people saw these marches through Australian streets in those peak years of the pandemic, a lot of people were like, oh, something, America has infected us with its conspiratorial vibes. Like it's just travelled over the internet via Facebook and via Twitter and YouTube, and suddenly it's infected the minds of Australians. And we didn't think that was the right story, or not the complete story. So the role of our book, or what we set out to do with the book, was to look at what has grown here, what that might say about us, and to say that there is something very Australian about the conspiracy theories that have taken off here, that have deep roots and that continue to grow.
And I want to dive into that a bit later, but firstly, Tracy, Age of Doubt looks at conspiracies as one aspect of declining trust. Is this a symptom of something wider?
Yes, is the short answer to that. I think there's a lot of things going on at the moment in society. I think we've got a serious cost of living issue happening, and politics has become very polarised. We've got the rise of social media and this fire hose of information that we have to sort through. We've also got sections of the community that are feeling really disenfranchised. And, you know, when you put those together, you get some fractures and you get people asking questions about what's true, and they can't figure out anymore who to believe because there's just so much information coming at them. And there's some really loud voices. Some of the anti-vax movement, some of the conspiracy theorists are very loud. And so individuals are seeking truth. Even people who are caught up in the really far out conspiracy theories are seeking truth. You know, they're trying to look at what's happening and what's real, and there's a lot of people that just can't find traction. They don't feel like they're getting ahead. And so they're questioning a lot about government, media. There's this idea of elitists who are kind of trying to take over. And that underpins a lot of the misinformation. And also, as you say, we've got disinformation, people who are deliberately trying to lie to us, particularly we see during elections that's heightened. Yeah, look, all the studies show that the more people feel disempowered, the less they believe in democracy, the less they believe in their government, the less they trust their media. And so as people struggle and feel like they can't achieve in this life, they can't get ahead, it's the same thing with the manosphere. They're finding an alternative way, and that is against the government, against mainstream media, against your public institutions, which are losing trust. And one of the writers in our book talks about, you know, if politicians could really understand that actually improving inequality, economic inequality, just making it possible for the people at the bottom to be able to find a way forward and to feel valued and to feel like that there's a path for them, actually makes them believe more in democracy, more in government, more in media, more in our educational institutions. And that, because we know we need that shared reality to make democracy work. And without that shared reality and that idea of the greater good, and when you have this extreme individualism that I'm the only one that matters and actually what matters is how I feel, facts don't matter so much, you know, then that's what you get. That conspiracy theories fuel that gap. And also just this sense that they can't, they've got no control anymore, and it's frightening for them. And so they grab hold of things where often it's the loudest voice talking to them and nobody is saying, no, that's not true. They grab hold of that. It's the same with extremism in other ways as well.
So there's something maybe in genuine grievance. Cam, you make a point in the book of saying you aren't going to use the term conspiracy theorist and that it's a loaded term. So why not?
We see people use the term conspiracy theorists to neg other people, to say what they believe in is wrong. It's a term of derision. It's hard to define what a conspiracy theorist is, because we refer to in the book some really good survey data on Australians and what they believe in. And one of the things that came out of it is that the majority of Australians say that they believe in a conspiracy theory. That range from everything from Harold Holt was kidnapped by the Chinese, all the way up to, you know, the idea that the government is pushing LED lights to make us docile and, you know, pay attention to what they say and not rise up against them. So some of these, you might guess, are kind of different in kind of tone and substance to others. Like, I don't think there's many people out there who are super Harold Holt-pilled and, you know, spend all their days thinking about how we can get back the Chinese and their navy for doing that. It also kind of gets down to the complicated nature of what it means to believe in something. You might say that you believe a conspiracy theory. You might joke about it. You know, I think conspiracy theories have actually become quite a big part of pop culture. You know, like you can see every time that Taylor Swift releases a teaser for a new album or, you know, even has an appearance in public, people are deciphering all the things that she's done, every single thing that could be a clue about a future album or a secret relationship or whatever. So that all makes it really complex to, you know, decide who believes in conspiracy theories, what it means, and who is defined as a conspiracy theorist. So for all those reasons, we kind of stayed away from the term. And what we looked at in the book was that subsection of people who get that conspiratorial thinking where they start to see conspiracy theories everywhere. Behind everything that happens, behind every event, there is always an alternate explanation that is both, you know, simpler but also more nefarious than anyone else understands. We look at in the book how that starts to affect people individually, but also us as a society.
Ariel, is there a sense of people wanting to belong to something that might be leading them to believe in certain conspiracies?
Yeah, I think there's an undeniable sense of community at play. So I'm just thinking back to a march I went to report on back in early 2023. It was called the, like, We Are Ready March. What they were ready to do was kind of unclear, but, you know, I showed up to Town Hall in Sydney and there were a lot of different signs. So there were signs about COVID vaccines being a scam. There were signs about 15-minute cities being a nefarious plan to lock us all down in our homes instead of a kind of town planning initiative that tries to make sure we can get everywhere we need in 15 minutes by walking or bike. There were signs about pedophile cabals, you know, the whole gamut of conspiracy theories. They were all present. And the mood was kind of friendly, you know. Everybody was there to see people they'd met only online. People were gathering in groups, meeting each other, chatting, live streaming. So the feeling, I think, for people that might have lost a lot of connection during the pandemic because of the lockdowns, because of the loss of jobs, there was an undeniable sense of community that was of strong appeal. And I think, too, when you are sort of begin your journey into a kind of conspiratorial land, especially online, you don't just get exposed to one. You might have started your interest because you have some doubts about vaccines, for example, but once you're in these communities, you get exposed to more and more and more, and it can kind of become a self-sealing worldview. And your friends and family may no longer understand why you're so obsessed with talking about this at the dinner table. They might get angry at you, but you may find solace with your friends in this new community, the only ones that really understand you now. So the sense of community is one appeal, but it's also, for people trying to extract people from this type of thinking, a challenge to offer a different type of community or, you know, an alternative for them as well.
Okay, let's dive into a conspiracy so we can get a better feel for some of the issues. I want to start with the Port Arthur massacre, because Ariel and Cam, in the book you say it's become one of the foundational stories in the construction of Australian conspiracy law. So first to the facts, in 1996, Martin Bryant shot and killed 35 people in and around Port Arthur in Tasmania. He pled guilty and is currently serving 35 life sentences in prison. Cam, what is it about the Port Arthur massacre story that has led to it being an Australian conspiracy theory?
It has emerged as one of these core stories in Australian conspiracy theory culture, because it's actually a core story in Australian modern history. Port Arthur itself, what happened there, you know, the death of 35 people and injured of a dozen or so more, it was like truly, truly awful. But what came out of it was something that is actually remembered as a really great part of Australian history, that Australian political leaders got together, they put aside, you know, vested interests, and they passed a law that restricted guns every time there is an act of gun violence in the US, which is quite often. It comes up as something that Australians are really proud of. It's become a really big part of our national identity. And so this idea that people would have this alternative, you know, idea of the event upsets a lot of people, because at their core, like, conspiracy theories are about, you know, often justifying an emotion. And the early conspiracy theories that came out about Port Arthur seemed to come out of often communities of gun owners who didn't like that these reforms were happening, that it was making it harder for them to do their hobby or to use it for work. Since then, it's kind of grown and it's become kind of totemic of, like, you know, this thing that we all know that we viewed as something is pretty universally as recognised as a really good thing. Actually, the government lied to you, and this thing that you thought is good is actually really bad because you were manipulated and you were tricked. That is why it's become such a core part of it, and because it's such a big event that everyone kind of knows about. And I think that, you know, in the world of Australian conspiracy theories, it's kind of this ultimate belief that politicians, that these powerful figures, whoever is behind it, are actually carrying out these massive manipulations against you, and that is a sin against you, and you should feel really bad about that. And if they tricked you about that, something that you believe and think is important, imagine what else they've tricked you about.
Did you want to add to that, Ariel?
Yeah, I was just thinking that in our book too, what we find, why we wanted to look at Port Arthur, was because we saw the sort of tendrils of Port Arthur conspiracy theories through many of the other communities we were looking at, you know, even in the writings of people that have gone on to commit acts of violence against police, you know, under the inspiration of conspiratorial thinking. You see them mentioning Port Arthur as this original sin of the Australian government, like an emblem of evil and an emblem of manipulation perpetrated against Australian people. But it's just so tied to the internet, because I think when Cam was talking to some of the people that were there immediately in the aftermath of Port Arthur, some of the journalists on the ground, politicians, survivors even, the conspiratorial narratives weren't there immediately, but they started to grow and spread as the internet grew and spread in Australian houses. So as people started to get these home internet connections, you can see these really early kind of GeoCity websites with the earliest kind of conspiratorial texts. They're spreading in like the comment sections on YouTube videos. It's just very interesting kind of internet history as well taking place here that tells us something about how Australians start to communicate online as well.
On ABC Radio National's Big Ideas Today with me, Natasha Mitchell, talking conspiracy theories, where they come from and the ways they can take hold. The co-authors of Conspiracy Nation, Exposing the Dangerous World of Australian Conspiracy Theories, technology journalists Ariel Bogle and Cam Wilson, and the co-editors of Age of Doubt, Building Trust in a World of Misinformation, Gavin Fang and Tracy Kirkland. Gavin, editorial director at the ABC, is asking the questions today at this Canberra Writers' Festival event.
Yeah, one of the things I think is interesting in the book and this particular chapter about Port Arthur is that it's almost a bit of an anatomy about how a conspiracy theory will develop, which runs a little bit alongside the development of the internet in Australia. So without kind of focusing too much necessarily on the internet, can you just talk to us a bit about how that those steps that really this Port Arthur conspiracy has taken?
Yeah, so in the book, part of the chapter is a profile on a guy called Joe Viles, who is a man who in the late 90s and early 2000s from his home office in suburban Perth was one of the great, I guess, outputters of conspiracy theories that have actually been really influential. He did conspiracy theories that became popular about the Bali bombing in Indonesia, but he was really the main guy who was kicking off a lot of these Port Arthur conspiracy theories. Clearly, people were writing to him and giving him information. He was putting out, you know, he put out a famous book called Deception at Port Arthur, which has since been referred to not by name, by, you know, politicians, by all kinds of people. And that figure seems like quite familiar to us now, you know, this idea that you'd have someone, you know, these leaders of, conspiratorial people who are using the internet to reach a lot of people. But that was quite novel. Like, he was one of the kind of the first people to use the internet in this way. He had this kind of quite funky looking blue, like dark blue background, light blue text website that was like awful in the eyes, that he would like write these long screeds that would then get put into PDFs and printed out and either emailed or handed out as pamphlets. And from there, he seemed to inspire many other people who would then also go on to be kind of influential conspiracy theorists. And from there, it kind of went to it got a kind of early foothold on YouTube, and then now there are still to this day Facebook groups with, you know, I think more than 10,000 people who are all talking about Port Arthur and why the massacre didn't happen as we say it did. So it's this story that, you know, while, you know, I spoke to someone who was actually at the Port Arthur historical site on the day and was working in one of the cafes, and she was saying, you know, shortly after it happened and she was traveling around the country and people would bring it up to her and that would be quite upsetting, it was kind of at the time very much kept in the, you know, people might be whispering to each other in pubs and talking about it. With the internet, you know, with getting rid of the gatekeepers, with allowing anyone to broadcast no matter what they were saying, that suddenly opened the floodgates for even just one person to reach a lot of people with their ideas, and that was something that paved the way for the spread of this conspiracy theory.
So, and it only takes one person. In our book too, we look at COVID, and I might not get the statistic exactly right, but I'm close. It's about 80% of the conspiracies or misinformation or disinformation about COVID came from 12 sources globally. 12. 80% of the things that were incorrect about COVID. And that shows you the scale that one person and the influence that one person can have, which is quite extraordinary.
Is the opportunity for that type of misinformation or disinformation and conspiracy able to spread because our institutions are weakened in some way?
Yeah, that's true. Because we have falling trust in government and in media and in our institutions, including our education institutions, as trust in those fall, I mean, that's where we used to come together to have really good public debate, and we trusted that debate. We trusted the outcomes. We trusted what the government and the media were telling us. And because that we're losing some of that trust, they're finding their facts in different places. And they're finding their facts, unfortunately, from Facebook, which is garbage. Facebook is fantastic for staying in touch with your friends. So, you know, you don't have to give it up. It's amazing to connect people, but it is terrible for information, for factual information. If you want to know the facts, you don't get them from Facebook. But unfortunately, what I find, I get cornered at parties, you know, and they just want to kind of go at me with the facts, which actually is like, I did the research. I hear that often. I did the research. It means they read something on Facebook. And it's very hard to have an argument with somebody who's getting their facts from Facebook. I think as our public institutions are suffering with a trust problem, that is definitely helping fuel misinformation and disinformation. So it's something that we have to take seriously and look at how we can fix that.
But the other thing that, you know, we really point out in our book is that, you know, conspiracy theories, particularly the ones that are really popular, the ones that take off, often kind of find toeholds in uncomfortable things about ourselves and sometimes lies that we tell about ourselves or failures. And, you know, I'm like, this is not me saying don't trust any institution, don't trust the media. But the media, of course, like any institution, has made problems in the past. You know, certain groups have been more represented in the media than others. But those are the kinds of things that have created the ground, the fertile ground for conspiracy theories to kind of grow out of. And so I think, you know, for when we're talking about like institutions and how we're doing this, like we're always trying to kind of improve, and we should be doing that to serve our audience as well. But also because we know the consequences is that if you're not listening to your audience, if you're not serving them well, if you're not telling them the truth, then they are going to go elsewhere. And now you can do that. In some ways, that's a good thing. There's been a lot of great independent media, but of course it has opened the door for some of the negative parts of it as well.
All right, well, let's get stuck into the media. We are field journalists. We might as well have a crack. Let's start with social media, I think. So Ariel, in your book, you're at pains to not blame the internet or social media, but we can't entirely count them out, can we, as drivers of conspiracies?
No, not at all. I think we blame them because people are making a lot of money off the situation that we find ourselves in. But I guess what we want to emphasise is we didn't find that social media had invented conspiratorial thinking in Australia or invented the conspiracy theories that we looked into. We found instead that it had helped people inclined to that type of thinking or interested in these topics find each other in ways they hadn't before. So these are the Facebook groups we were always talking about. This is the YouTube comment section. This is the emails, the newsletters, the Twitter followers, etc. You know, conspiratorial thinking has always been with us. It's a human instinct, I think, to tell stories and find meaning in chaos and look for clues and put yourself at the centre of an epic story, which is really what conspiracy theory is, you know, this fight between good and evil. So it's nothing new, but the internet has allowed it to communities to find each other, I suppose. And it was interesting, Cam, I think you did speak to somebody that was in one of the Port Arthur conspiracy theory communities, and he spoke about the community that he found there and the way it exposed him to new conspiracy theories perhaps he hadn't even considered before.
Yeah, so I spoke to someone right now who recently got into Port Arthur conspiracy theories, and he said, I think I had some questions about it, and then I got into it, and he even kind of told me in a really kind of like normal, like not fussed way that he was like helped harass this other, there was a police officer who had been one of the early ones to attend Port Arthur after the shooting happened, and now he'd kind of taken this role about trying to dispel people about these conspiracy theories, and this guy I was speaking to just very normally was just like, and yeah, we kind of bullied him and then he left the internet, and I was like, okay. But I, like, you know, he spoke about how they were getting him, introducing him into other conspiracy theories as well. And, you know, we were talking about the social aspect before. You know, this is also very linked into social media now as well, because of everything is, you know, you're recommended kind of pieces of content. And so if you like one conspiracy theory, it makes sense that maybe you would like another. And that happens through a manual means as well, when other people are introducing yourself. That's how we think the internet has really changed the way that conspiracy theories work, because in the past, if you believed something that was a conspiracy theory, you might go up to someone and you might say, hey, what do you think about this? And they might say, you're a weirdo. Now, if you believe a conspiracy theory, you can find a group of people who believe the same thing, who will tell you that you're right, and they'll also introduce you to some new ones. That is something that you couldn't do in the same way before.
And I'll just quickly say too, like in the book, we do feel a lot of sympathy, I think, for some people that have fallen into this way of thinking in a moment of crisis, a health crisis, a financial crisis. But we do reserve criticism, of course, for the people that we would call, I guess, conspiracy theory influencers or sort of gurus. And that is another thing the internet has done in removing gatekeepers to information. If you are somebody that's got like a legal problem and you go on the internet, instead of good legal resources, you may well find someone who's going to sell you a $500 course over Zoom that teaches you that the law of Australia doesn't really exist, so you can just ignore it. Like, this is very common. And so that is another way that the internet has allowed people to monetize and promote conspiratorial tropes, narratives, thinking in a way that's pretty unprecedented.
But Tracy, what about us? We're all representatives of the mainstream media, so surely we've got a role to play somewhere. You can be representative of the mainstream media for this one. But does the media have something to answer for maybe a decline in trust that might be leading to the emergence of people looking to find alternate solutions or doing their own research, for example?
Yeah, can I just deal with social media first? because, look, my best friend got involved in the anti-vax movement so much so that she's never spoken to me again because I'm in the mainstream media. So she thinks that I am in cahoots with the government to infect her brain, put 5G in her brain and make her a Satanist or something, I'm not sure. But she has not. She was a very normal... We have been best friends for a long time and it came out of nowhere. She sold her house, went off grid, didn't tell me where she went, told me the day she was leaving, and has never spoken to me again. So people who... And I knew that she had some anti-vax views and we kind of didn't talk about it. That's how the friendship kind of progressed. But once they've decided that the government is out to get them or somebody has got some agenda and they believe a certain theory, the other conspiracy theories kind of become the same in that it's they're out to get us. Somebody is out. China, the government, whoever it is that they don't like, the media, is lying to them for a purpose. They're really out to get them. I think once you've believed one, you can then kind of believe all of them because they've got that same underpinning that they're out to get someone's out to get you. Saying that, do the mainstream media have a role to play? Absolutely, we do. And that role is first and foremost to be accurate so that people have a place to go to find accurate information. And at the ABC, we hold that as our highest bar, that we must be accurate. Look, we make mistakes, so I'm not saying that we don't, but we hold that very, very high because we have to have places where people can go to find accurate information because we live in a time where it's so hard to find. And we live in a time with more information than ever before at our fingertips, yet it's hard to actually figure out what's true and what's not true. And as we said before, that's where the misinformation can get in and people are deceived. And once they're there, once they've decided, it's very, very hard, almost impossible to bring them back.
Cam, Ariel, how do you feel about that? You were talking to people that are believing in conspiracy theories. I'm sure you've tried to engage with them with mainstream data, for instance, that might be in the types of publications that you work for. What's the role of the media in this?
When we sort of embarked on this book, we were looking at the way that these ideas spread. And when we took a kind of historical view, we did have to acknowledge that parts of the media had played a really strong role in the spread of some of these conspiratorial tropes. There are examples we track in the book, say much of the discussion about healthcare for LGBTQ+ people, parts of the Australian media have indulged in conspiratorial language, not language based in science or accurate psychology or anything like that, but rather conspiratorial narratives of plots against Australian children. And of course, children are such an emotional linchpin for conspiracy theories for centuries, which we look at in the book as well. But there have been plenty of examples through the history of Australian media where conspiracy language has been on the front page. You know, we have to acknowledge that as well. And I think too, on a broad scale, people aren't stupid. You know, they can see when the media is holding back, when it is using a false notion of, you know, pure objectivity, which is, you know, that's a debate for another time, to be accurate but not truthful, I think might be the divide. So there were lots of discussions with people in the book about what their ideas were, but I suppose the intention of our book was not to convince them that they were wrong. It was to understand what these ideas meant for them or why they felt they needed them. Because I think that is really one strong reason why people turn to conspiratorial ideas, is because of a need to put a simple narrative over a chaotic environment. So, you know, people were turning to these ideas in a moment of crisis. One woman who was losing her home I spoke to, she had an issue with the bank, and instead of getting, you know, traditional legal help, she'd turned to a kind of pseudo-law guru that was teaching her about all the ways the Australian government had become corrupted and thus our laws were illegitimate, so she didn't need to engage with the court in a normal way, you know, and obviously led her down a very bad and dangerous path. But she turned to these ideas in a moment of need, and traditional legal services didn't get to her before he did, you know. So this is the way that conspiratorial thinking travels, I think, and the media plays both a good and a bad role in that too.
Is there a pathway, or are there signs that we can identify that someone might be going down a path to believing something that might be a conspiracy theory?
Yeah, it's really difficult. I mean, I wish in the book we'd stumbled across the three-step plan to remove, you know, dangerous, quote-unquote dangerous thinking from someone's mind, but obviously that's not the case. Conspiracy theories will always be with us, so, you know, and a plan of total elimination is not possible and not even really a worthy goal, because these are our ideas people play with. It's when people sort of, you know, start building their lives around them, dedicating themselves to a complete worldview, that the danger really perhaps arrives. I guess in thinking through how to address it, I might just talk through the story of a psychologist I spoke to, and he had a couple of clients during the pandemic who started to share some of these ideas with him. A lot of it was fears about the vaccine, but there was also like tinges of QAnon and videos about Russia and Ukraine that he didn't quite understand and things like that. And at first it just really threw him, because one of his clients, I think, compared refusing to be vaccinated to being a Jew during the Holocaust, and he was just like, what are you talking about? So he just didn't know how to approach the act of like giving this person therapy anymore. So they had a bit of a standoff about it, but eventually he started talking to at least one of these clients who was, I think, had been in the Defence Force, had an injury, was getting difficulty getting the services he needed to deal with that injury and not being able to work in the same way anymore. And he realised that he could keep talking to this person, he would decline to talk to them about the, you know, the facts and the figures of all these ideas, but he did want to understand again what that person was getting out of these ideas, why they felt a need for these ideas, and sort of find the thread of why he'd turned to them. And it turned out too that when the person did manage to get the help that he needed, when those material conditions kind of resolved for him, his need for these more extreme ideas also started to decline. So I think that teaches us something about, again, dealing with these root causes. You know, why do people turn to these ideas? You know, I mean, just a quick caveat, a lot of people with a lot of material wealth also turn to these ideas. You know, I think the appeal there might be some idea of feeling up like you're in the middle of your own Hollywood film. You know, the conspiracy theories do put you kind of the centre of this epic story, and you feel like you've got the secret, and it is a means for audience and sort of social power. But for people that might stumble onto this in a moment of crisis, dealing with those things about access to healthcare, access to legal services, understanding of how government works, greater government transparency, I think are all these sort of building blocks for dealing with this at the very root cause.
Conspiracy Theories, the why, the what, the how, with me, Natasha Mitchell, bringing you ABC Radio National's Big Ideas, with four journalists who have gone down that rabbit hole. They've lived to tell the story, and the story of the impact on people's lives, families and our communities. Ariel Bogle and Cam Wilson are co-authors of Conspiracy Nation, Exposing the Dangerous World of Australian Conspiracy Theories, and the co-authors of Age of Doubt, Building Trust in a World of Misinformation, Tracy Kirkland and Gavin Fang. Gavin's hosting this Canberra Writers' Festival session.
So, Cam, in the book you reflect on a number of ways that we can tackle people getting caught up in conspiracy. Ariel touched on a few there, but let's talk through them in detail. First, you talk about the media, the courts, and broadly our public institutions. Thoughts on what we can do there and how we can help?
I mean, I think one of there's actually this phrase that I heard after the book came out, which is a pain, but I'll give it to you guys now, which is that everything looks like a conspiracy theory if you don't know how it works. And it's the idea that, you know, from the outside, like institutions, organisations, even what we think about people can seem like everything is coordinated, controlled, it's all part of some big plan, you know, they're meant to do it. But as I'm sure all of you know, having been inside, you know, some kind of institution, whether it's a footy club or a workplace or whatever, you often know that the decisions that are made are not just because of some ideology, but often because, I don't know, someone didn't show up for work that day or, you know, someone was sick or whatever. The thing that will go some way to help with people believing and understanding or even just perceiving that these alternative stories that they're being told could be believable, you know, the kind of entryway into this stuff is by allowing people to understand how they actually work, by doing more to let people behind the curtain to see how these things that are in their lives, sometimes not by choice, you know, thinking about the legal system, we have no real choice that we've kind of got to live within it, to let them know how it works so they can understand why decisions are being made that affect their life. So, you know, with journalism, when I was, one of my early jobs when I was at BuzzFeed, one of the things that they did really, really well was they always said, like, show your own working. Like, they actually said that audiences love actually seeing some of this stuff done behind the scenes that often I think traditional news outlets didn't really show, but just explaining how you kind of came to ideas, even being like, this is, you know, these are the doors that we knocked on to go talk to these people. For things like, you know, legal systems, helping people understand what decisions are being made, taking the time to talk about them. And in the book, you know, we talk, there's a very famous a conspiracy theorist in Australia who got sucked into conspiracy theories because of, I think, road traffic violation. And then he went to court. And when he went to court, he said, I have, you know, I believe these things, and this is why I, you know, the law doesn't apply to me. And the magistrate said, hey, you know, like quietly took his time calmly and gave him an opportunity to have his say, but then also said, I don't think that's right, and gave him some more resources. And it was almost like a coincidence that that was able to happen because that magistrate had some other cases that were supposed to be on that day that ended up not happening. And so as a result, he had the time to have the patience to go through it with this guy. That guy ended up becoming one of, creating this really, really important, he ended up getting out of conspiracy theories and now runs an extremely helpful resource about conspiracy theories, about sovereign citizen and pseudo-war ideas in Australia. But it kind of only happened because of that twist of fate where this magistrate had the time to be empathetic, to understand, to explain, and then also, you know, show how he could kind of get out of that. That is like, it's hard to do. It's great to say, all you got to do is, you know, have all the time in the world, you know, have the patience. I wish we could all have that. But that is one of the things that institutions need to start to prioritise, being like, how do we let people know what we do? Because it's not just something that is, you know, makes them feel good and us feel good. It's important to them still trusting that we are actually working for them.
Tracy, as a community, can we do something to help with people accessing facts and not being caught up with mis and disinformation?
I think there's a lot we can do. I think at the moment our social discourse or the way we talk or the way we decide things happens online. So it's not like the old Greeks who would sit around and kind of discuss the problems of society and come up with solutions. Now we thrash it out online and there's so much wrong there. It's shouty, it's divisive, it's angry, and people personally attack each other. So if you try and make a point on social media, someone will come back and say, well, I hate you and you're fat. I mean, it's just irrelevant to the discussion, but that's the kind of discourse we're having online. And how do we solve today's big issues if that's the kind of discussion we have? So I think we need to think really carefully about our social discourse. I think we need to ask as a country who we want to be. What kind of discussions do we want to have? What kind of things do we want to talk about and find solutions to together? And I think transparency is another one, particularly for the media. We need to be really transparent, the same as Cam said, about how we do it, and so that people can trust the process. When Gavin and I sat down to work out this book, we didn't there's a lot of problems and it can be a little bit overwhelming. And in our book, we deal with AI, we deal with chatbots, we deal with all the current issues that have got us kind of scared and riled up, conspiracy theories as well. But we wanted to ask, like, what can we do about it? And how can we find solutions to this? And we asked every writer to come up with solutions. So the book is full of solutions. And some of them are really explicit. Some of them around our public institutions need to go back to where they started and figure out what are they for? They've lost direction. They're now about money making, or they're not the same as when they were first set up. So do we either crush them down and start again, or do we go back to our roots? There's some people want more regulation, like the social media ban for under 16s, which has happened since we published the book. There's a lot of solutions in the book, and there's actually, when you read it, you're like so relieved that there's actually a lot we can do as a community. There's a lot we can do individually, and I think media literacy is one of them, or literacy around where you get your information is one of them. So there's tons of solutions, and as I said about economic inequality as well, working there, there's lots, and the book is kind of full of them, thank goodness, because otherwise it's a bit...
And Ariel, what can we do individually to make sure that we can navigate the information environment to maybe arm ourselves against falling to some of these conspiracies or misinformation?
Ooh, big question. Well, you know, as I am a biased commentator on this, because I do think people should choose some media outlets and subscribe to them. You need to pay for journalism for it to exist. That's probably not the, what everybody wants to hear. But I will say too, I was just thinking, because when we've done some of these events before, people are like, can't you just tell me what to do with my brother-in-law, my aunt, uncle, you know? And I guess just to go think back to Damien, who was the psychologist I spoke to, I wanted to say to people too, like, people can come back. So it's case by case, but unless there are genuine risks, you know, whether it be a health risk if they refuse to get vaccinated and you know, have children immunocompromised, or, you know, other risks, if they are starting to use conspiracy theories as just elaborate cover for racism, of course you may not want to maintain relationships, but continuing those ties that bind us together can allow people a path back, offering that separate type of community. But also, yeah, with the media thing, it is hard, and I do think the quote-unquote mainstream media has failed to deliver news in the and factual information in the way that people now consume it. So it is incumbent on us to adapt to new environments, to make sure that we're present in these spaces and not disdain them simply because they are also full of muck. I mean, we have to cut through somehow, which I know is extremely difficult. But yeah, I suppose, you know, choosing a few institutions that you don't have to trust them blindly. You don't have to trust any of the media outlets we work for blindly. You can understand where we might come from, the kind of ethos or biases that the media outlet might have, but you can read it with clear eyes and see where the information is coming from and write to your reporters and tell them how you want things done differently.
Fantastic, thank you. Now, we've got a few minutes for some questions. So I think we've got a roving mic, if you pop up your hand.
Thanks. You've told us so much in both your books about how conspiracy theories and misinformation take hold of people, and it's clear that it fills all sorts of needs that facts don't, that facts don't change people's minds, but it's these narratives and value systems and all the rest of the emotional stuff. So if we're trying to combat that with facts, it's never going to work. So I guess my question is, what should we be doing instead?
Well, I think the people who are on the extremes are really hard to turn. You can't present them facts and they won't turn. Where you need to put your effort is in the people who are undecided, the people who aren't sure, because they're the people that... So for the anti-vax movement, for example, you've got extreme anti-vaxxers. You won't change their mind with facts. They will just not believe you and say you're elitist and you don't care. And they'll present you with emotional things like children. It's going to impact our children, and that's the way they operate. But you have this section of people who are unsure which way, whether, you know, vaccination is good or bad. And they're the people that are open to hear facts. But unfortunately, what's happened post-COVID is the anti-vaxxers have become larger, that section's become larger, and the section of people who are unsure about vaccination has moved down. And so there's less people who are are willing to hear facts. But we have to stand by the facts in science, in the media, in everything. I mean, facts should dictate how we behave, and we still need to use facts to combat misinformation and disinformation. We must. But we have to also be literate and understand. I mean, when we talk about chatbots in our book, the person doing the research thought, oh, there was all this weird kind of social media posting on the Great Barrier Reef. And when they looked at it, it was actually entirely done by bots. Like, and one of the statistics in our book is that 80% of what you read in X is written by a bot. 80% of what you read in Twitter is by a bot. And so you have to be able to question where you're getting your information, and facts have still got to be, in my opinion, very, very high on the agenda. And anyone who's manipulating you with emotional language, you need to question that.
I wonder if you four have delicately avoided this. My question is, when I was young, our conspiracy theories, let's face it, were good old-fashioned hippies and lefties. All of the Australian conspiracy theorists, let's just neg them, all the bookers are far, far right, with a large dose, for most of them, of actually religious far right. They've become so far right that we're watching a morphing of our anti-vaxxers into March for Australia racists with Nazis addressing them. What the hell is going on with imported far right?
Cam, Ariel, what's happening? Has our conspiracies becoming dominated by things on the far right?
I mean, I think that there is definitely, I mean, like, it's not controversial to say that, you know, in parts of the right around the world, conspiracy theories have become an increasingly large part of mainstream discourse. So, there, you know, it happens in both sides of politics, but I think in, like, you know, for example, you could look at what's happening in the US and see how conspiratorial ideas have played a big part in the MAGA movement. So we should be clear-eyed about that. And I think, you know, we talk about this in the book. We are sympathetic towards people who get sucked into these things, but we are critical of the people who promote them. And we do see politicians around the world, in Australia, elsewhere, willing to use sometimes explicit conspiracy theories or just kind of conspiratorial rhetoric to push their own causes. And I think, like I said, we like to be sympathetic towards people who get sucked into these things. But I also think that we have to have a kind of essentially a zero tolerance for when people get into these falsehoods about us, because I think that they do have a real corrosive effect on democracy.
Down the front here.
First off, love the book. Thank you for writing it. You spent a lot of time really defining what conspiracy theories and the people who believe them are, and I really appreciate that definition. So I've written down a few things you've said: different reality, answering big questions, justifying emotion, community, yearning for acceptance, evils lurking. How is this different to religion? How, and I know that's going to upset some people, and I really don't mean to upset people, but you look at Q as a preacher, you look at Viles as a preacher, writing script, writing pamphlets, do your own research. You know, I get this, isolating in a family of non-believers. It's a slippery slope. Right now it's 42% of Christians in Australia. That's a big conspiracy theory. How do we differentiate?
Right, let's blend religion and conspiracy theories. Here we go. What have you got, Ariel?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a great question, a very tough one. I'm not sure I feel fully qualified to comment on religious belief in Australia necessarily, but maybe I'll just draw some threads from the book. You might remember a man who had really been a believer in kind of pseudo-law sovereign citizen ideas and had come out of that belief, but he told me he did think his upbringing, I think he was Jehovah's Witness, had prepped him in some way for that type, for the slippage into that type of thinking because of its emphasis on ideas of prophecy, stories about that encourage you to look for signs in your environment around you, for clues that of a coming apocalypse or a coming catastrophe of the Antichrist, things like that. And I mean, just as a side note, Peter Thiel, the techno, what would you call it, the billionaire, the man behind many kind of surveillance technologies in the United States, is now doing a tour talking about his definitions of the Antichrist. So the term Antichrist is really on the way back. But I will note too, in the wake of I think there was a strong religious thread in some parts of the anti-lockdown movement, which you could see very clearly if you attended any of the talks or rallies. And then two, as that movement started to wane and as its key leaders cast around for another topic to kind of keep the momentum, keep energy, there was a definite turn for the religious, and we do track that a bit in the book as well.
I would just say that I think like there are some similarities between conspiracy theories and religion, because there are similarities between conspiracy theories and a whole bunch of unprovable beliefs that we all have. You know, like we talk about old wives' tales, you know, things that your family has told you that you believe that you've never actually proven yourself. That's kind of why, you know, one big thing that I took out of this book is that the way that I, you know, the way that I form my beliefs isn't necessarily that different to someone who believes in a conspiracy theory. You know, I haven't rigorously proven everything I believe in. Yes, there's some difference in the form, and so there's no doubt some similarities between other kinds of thinking, but that actually should make us all realise just how people who believe in conspiracy theories are not others. They are very similar to ourselves, and we should think about that, because we could believe in them, and that's why we should be sympathetic to other people who believe in them as well.
Sorry, I'm going to have to weigh in here. And it might not be what you want, but I have a lot of sympathy for people who are believers of all religions. It's the extremists that are the problem. Most people who are believers of all religions are very moderate, and they're beautiful people. And the reason that we have a lot of charities and a lot of good in our society is because of what religion has brought. That is not denying that there is a crossover, but I think the crossover happens at the fringes, at the extremes, and that's dangerous. It's dangerous in religion, it's dangerous in society, and that's where conspiracy theories come. And the thing that we need to concern ourselves with, and it's the same with the anti-vax movement, is that what used to be in the fringes is now in the mainstream. And I think that's where we need to turn our attention. Most faithful religious people across our society, including in Australia, are wonderful community members and leaders, and I would hate for their faith, which is often gentle and really dictates their behaviour, to be smeared because of the people in the extreme.
That's all we've got time for. I want to finish by thanking our panel, Cam, Ariel and Tracy. If we can give them a round of applause.
Tracy Kirkland rounded off that discussion led by Gavin Fang. They're co-editors of the book Age of Doubt, Building Trust in a World of Misinformation. Gavin's editorial director at the ABC, where Tracy is managing editor of ABC News. And they were with Guardian Australia investigative journalist Ariel Bogle and associate editor of Crikey, Cam Wilson. Both top journos who specialise in tech and internet culture. Their new book is called Conspiracy Nation, Exposing the Dangerous World of Australian Conspiracy Theories. Big thanks to the Canberra Writers Festival who put this discussion together. Email us. We'd love to hear from you on this one. I know many families have been affected. BigIdeas@abc.net.au. And you can find Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts to listen anytime or share us with your friends. Next on the show, Stan Grant, longtime journalist, now a theologian and professor, on reclaiming a language of love in a time of division. Can't wait to hear that. I'm Natasha Mitchell.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.